Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by BlackRock Health, providing patients with world-class clinical care and comfort, enabling swifter recoveries.
Tweet at Miriam O'Call.
Now, autism is a condition which affects tens of thousands of people in Ireland, with scarcely a family here untouched in some way by the condition. Well, my next guest was diagnosed with Asperger's, a form of autism, when he was 34. And he's written about this in his just published book, Untypical: How the World Isn't Built for Autistic People and What We Should All Do About It, a book which has been rocketing its way to the bestseller lists. And its author, Pete Warmby, joins me now. Good morning to you, Pete.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Can you begin by telling us, Pete, a little about yourself? I know you were diagnosed with a form of autism when you were 34. So how difficult, Pete, did that make the first 34 years of your life?
Very good question. Obviously for that whole 34 years, I had no idea. You know, I had no clue that I didn't really know very much about autism, to be honest. Certainly not, you know, when I was much younger. But being different in that way, and you know, if you're autistic, then the differences can be quite considerable. Things like differences in communication style, differences in how we interpret sensory kind of information and things like that can make life quite difficult. But the trouble is, if you don't have the diagnosis, then you have no idea why you're feeling that way, you know. So I basically spent my entire, you know, first part of my life just assuming that I was a bit kind of I don't know, really, like fragile or a bit flaky, you know, like not really capable of managing the world, which is obviously quite a negative way of viewing yourself. You know, you just kind of think you can't handle things as well as everybody else, and you don't really know why.
So how then, Pete, did your diagnosis come about? Like, what was happening in your life, or how did it come about?
Well, it all kind of came to a head when I became a parent for the first time. As I think it does for a lot of people, actually, because obviously that's a huge upheaval. You know, everything changes in your life when that happens. And as an autistic person, an autistic person who didn't know it about myself, I'd kind of built up a load of very strict kind of routines and systems to help me get through each day. And the arrival of a baby on the scene kind of tore that all apart, as it does, you know. And so I found myself, you know, really unable to cope in a very, very deep kind of way. So I was just casting around for answers, really. You know, why was it so difficult? And I found out about autism. I researched it quite heavily. And then I contacted, you know, I just contacted the doctors, and they got me the referral and so on and so forth. Back in 2017, the NHS over here wasn't too bad with that. These days, it's much more difficult. It takes a lot longer. But back in 2017, it was a fairly quick process. But yeah, it was looking for an answer as to why I was finding it so difficult.
And is it true, Pete, that you did some online tests that if it was over 30-something, it was maybe you were, and you were over 70? Tell me about the test you did.
Yes. Yeah, there's quite a few online tests out there, and that they have a various, you know, kind of different levels of usefulness. But the one that I did there, I think, if I remember rightly, it was the, I can't even remember what it was called now. But it was one of the ones that I remember when I went in for my official diagnosis, they basically handed me the same test, only on paper. I wish I could remember what it was called. But yeah, I sat down one evening and just did it. It was one of those multiple choice things where it gave you questions like, I don't know, you know, would you, or one of the famous ones is, would you rather go to a museum or a party? Which feels now a little bit of a silly question. But, you know, I put museum because parties are terrifying, noisy places. But it's things like that. And it calculates all of your answers. And yes, if it was over 30, then you might want to consider it. But yeah, my mind came out, you know, it almost felt like it needed like a siren to go off and like a red light to start flashing or something, you know, saying, yeah, you know, you really do need to look into this, because my score was so high.
Was that diagnosis, was it a relief to get it or not?
It was, yes. Yeah, initially there was more just shock than anything. But as I said a moment ago, you know, I'd spent so much of my life just thinking and blaming myself for being very, very kind of incapable, you know, dealing with the pressures of the world, that it came as a relief to at least understand why. You know, I mean, it didn't necessarily offer any easy answers, but it gave me a, you know, like a reason. It gave me a way then to start looking for answers in a more targeted way, you know, in a more kind of impactful way. So yeah, it was very relieving, really. I started to treat myself with more kindness, you know?
Yeah, which is great. I mean, and in your book, which is a wonderful read, you refer to autism as a whirlwind of anxiety. Is that anxiety unrelenting?
yeah. Well, certainly for me, it kind of is. Yes, but there are moments where it kind of calms down, but there's so many sources of it. You know, most of the anxiety, I think, that most autistic people at least experience stems from a combination of those communication differences that we have, which can lead to incredible amounts of miscommunication, you know, misunderstandings, getting the wrong end of the stick, not getting jokes or telling jokes that other people don't get, you know. And we all know how that feels. You know, we all know how one instance of miscommunication can feel really bad, you know, like you just feel kind of, you know, embarrassed and stressed. But for a lot of autistic people, it's a constant thing. You know, we're experiencing it every day, and it builds up and it builds up and it builds up. And, you know, to the point where every communication moment, every sociable moment, including like a conversation like this, has this this potential to go so wrong, you know, that you're obviously always on edge. Well, I mean, I certainly am anyway, you know, just waiting for that miscommunication to happen. And then on top of that, like I say, I've got this, you know, got the sensory difficulty, you know, the fact that for many autistic people, our senses are really dialed right up, you know, where we're dramatically sensitive to things like light and sound and heat, cold, taste, smells, those kind of things. So again, that's constantly bombarding you, you know. So by the time you get to adulthood, you know, you're exhausted by all of this, you know, and the anxiety is, yeah, it's unrelenting. It's pretty constant.
And you also write, Pete, about the importance of routine in the lives of many autistic people. How important is that routine, and what kind of things could disrupt your life, for instance?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is so important. I mean, I talk about it a lot as being a kind of natural response to that, you know, stress and that anxiety. You know, it's like a way to imprint at least a little bit of control onto the world when you feel out of control, you know. So you set up this routine for yourself. And it just reduces stress levels, you know, by whatever amount, because at least you know what you're going to be dealing with, you know, every part of the day. And yeah, when it goes wrong, which obviously it will do, because, you know, the world is a chaotic place, it can be very difficult to handle. And that's when a lot of autistic people will report, you know, stress levels skyrocketing and what we often call autistic overwhelm or meltdown, where we just, you know, we hit our ceiling of what we can handle. Everyone's got a ceiling. It's just we tend to hit it more often. and then things spiral, you know, out of control. So the routines become a way of avoiding that. And if you have an autistic person in your life, then an awareness of the importance of those routines and, you know, doing everything you can to try to maintain them, you know, within reason. Obviously, it's not always possible, but any way that you can try to maintain them can be so valuable.
And how do you define autism? I know neurodiverse is a word I think we all try to use a lot these days. But I mean, it's also the spectrum is so wide, Pete, isn't it? I mean, how do you define autism?
Well, it's very difficult to. I mean, the it's interesting, you know, the concept of the autistic spectrum, you know, certainly in my mind, more refers to just the vast variety of autistic experience that exists. You know, no two autistic people really have the same kind of presentation or profile. You know, we all have, you know, for example, I am very sensitive to sound, whereas I can eat pretty much anything, whereas another autistic person might have no problem with sound at all, but have tremendous limitations in what kind of tastes and textures they can handle in their food. And that's before you even get onto things like co-occurring conditions like ADHD or dyspraxia, dyslexia, and so on and so forth. So it can be very difficult, but mostly being autistic is having that that communication difference primarily is a really big part of it. Sensory differences is a huge part too, as is what we call monotropism. That's a really crucial aspect of being autistic. And monotropism is a kind of posh, it's a good word really, that means kind of single focus.
Okay.
Like single point of focus, like almost like tunnel vision, but not quite as negative an idea. It's the reason why autistic people can so frequently hone in and focus in on a task or an activity or an interest or whatever it might be, seemingly inexhaustibly. You know, they can just keep going, you know, and that's something that a lot of autistic people celebrate about their experience. You know, they have that ability. It's what drives what we call special interests. You know, those kind of real single-minded, fascinating things that autistic people often have.
Yeah, absolutely. And you write movingly about your school days. And I'm conscious, Pete, there's probably parents listening this morning who have children,
yes,
who are autistic and who might, you know, try to learn something from you. I mean, you say the experiences you went through, probably many other autistic children are going through. What do you remember as being stressful about the school environment for you? And what do you think could be done to help that environment for children?
I think I found the relentless sensory difficulties the most hard to handle at school, especially in certain subjects where, you know, there were different smells and different expectations, where the routine maybe broke a little bit. You know, so you were doing science experiment or, I don't know, doing PE, you know, going and doing sports outside. I found those changes in routine and those changes in sensory environment really, really hard to handle, to the point that I would do anything to avoid them. And that's something that a lot of autistic children, students at school experience, you know, a desperate desire to avoid these things that are so, so difficult for them. And often that's chalked up as being bad behavior or just, you know, being stubborn or willful or whatever, you know, whatever you want to call it. When in reality, it's a much stronger self-preservation kind of thing going on, you know, where the student recognizes they know they can't handle this aspect and they do everything they can to avoid it, only to be, you know, judged by the teachers or maybe their parents as well as just being, I don't know, lazy or, you know, something more negative. And I think it's important to be compassionate and recognize that whatever difficulties the student might be having in school, it's not necessarily just going to be a way of trying to get out of something because they can't be bothered, you know, or they just don't like it in a fairly, oh, I just don't like this kind of way. You know, it might be much deeper than that. It might be a, you know, almost phobia-like, you know, that there's a fear there, perhaps, that demands, I think, a little bit more compassion and patience and understanding. I mean, I would always say that any school that can be a bit more flexible in how it, you know, delivers practical sessions or sports lessons or whatever it might be is going to be more friendly to autistic students.
Really interesting. And I suppose one of the greatest challenges, Pete, I'd imagine for many autistic people is it's being what you describe in the book as an invisible disability. I mean, how do we make it more visible or what can we all do as a society to recognise it to a greater extent?
Yeah, I actually wrote about this the other day. I think the key thing is to believe us when we talk about it, because it is invisible. You know, there is no look. It's astonishing how often people get, you know, if you open up and say, oh, I'm autistic, by the way, how frequently the response is something along the lines of, oh, you don't look it. Because that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
You know, there is no look to autism, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't come with, you know, I don't kind of get like a hat that I have to wear or anything like that. So it's very interesting how that's the kind of immediate knee-jerk reaction. But another very common response that, I mean, if there are autistic people listening, they may well have experienced themselves, especially if they're women or you know, people of color or something like that, you know, who don't tend to be associated with autism more, is, no, you're not. You can't be. You're more autistic. Or even worse, don't be so hard on yourself, as if it's like some kind of self-inflicted insult or something. It's very, very odd. What we need, I think, personally, is for there just to be a greater blanket level of just belief that if you say that you're autistic, then yeah, just, you know, they are, you know, rather than arguing the point, which seems to be a very common thing. It's a very strange reaction as far as I can see, but it happens an awful lot.
Peter, we have lots of reactions to you, but one question, a primary teacher from Pat has come in saying, does your guest have any reservations about the common assumption that integrating autistic children into mainstream classrooms is a good thing? What do you think about that, Pete?
Well, it's interesting. It depends really on the means of the integration. I mean, I think that autistic students, generally speaking, can very often, you know, get by pretty happily within mainstream classes, so long as there are accommodations made. So, for example, small things like allowing them to what we call stim, you know, like fidget a little bit, maybe with a little toy, or maybe let them get up and walk around, that kind of thing, because that's an incredibly important kind of regulatory thing that autistic people do to maintain their own stress levels. I'm doing it now, for example. You know, I've got some Lego people that I'm kind of fiddling with as I talk. But often, of course, students don't get allowed to do that. You know, they're told off, or they're told to sit down, or whatever it might be. But I think with sufficient, fairly small accommodations, then a large number of autistic students can get by quite reasonably, you know, quite happily, even in mainstream. It depends on whether there's any co-occurring conditions, you know, that can make things a little bit more complicated. But if we're just talking about autism itself, then I think it can be very successful, so long as those accommodations are put in place and followed, you know, kind of rigorously.
And I thought that was interesting reading your book as well, that, and you mentioned it just there, Lego yes. does have, you know, I'm just thinking, even for any autistic people listening or parents of autistic children, you find it really beneficial, don't you, Pete?
Oh, yes, tremendously so. I always have, ever since I was a kid. I wrote about it in more detail in my first book, where I talk more about these autistic special interests.
Yeah.
But there's something about a combination of, you know, obviously how it works, the way that you build things, you can dismantle them, but also just the sensory feel of the bricks and the way they look. I don't know. It just seems to tick an awful lot of boxes for me and for a large number of autistic people. It really is a relatively common, you know, autistic fascination, I've found. And I've never sufficiently managed to identify exactly why that is, but there must be a reason.
Broadly speaking, do you think society is improving? Are we improving in our awareness and understanding of autism or not?
I think things are considerably... It's very easy to be very pessimistic, and I tend to... you know, kind of gravitate towards pessimism on these things. Because, you know, every day you just hear another horror story about some autistic kid being restrained or something like that, or even worse, in the USA, you know, an autistic child being like attacked by the police and things like this. And you just think, oh, goodness me, we've got such a long way to go. But then I remember how things used to be even just 10 years ago, you know, and I've looked into how things have changed over the last 5 to 10 years. And we are an awful lot better now as a society, I think. You know, ultimately, I think, yes, we're much better. That society is much more aware, I think, and slightly more accepting of autism as a difference. But I do feel like, yes, there is an awfully long way to go. And my worry is that there isn't necessarily the will to get there. You know, there are an awful lot of autistic people out there trying to share their experience. You know, it's by no means just me. There are thousands of us, you know, all talking, all online, you know, writing blogs and Twittering and all that kind of thing, doing YouTube and TikTok videos. We're all trying to communicate and to tell the world, hey, you know, we're here, we're different in these ways, and we'd appreciate your help if you can. And it often feels like it's falling on deaf ears, you know, and I think a lot of minorities experience this. You know, it's just the way that the world goes, I suppose. But it can feel very frustrating and quite sad sometimes.
Your book is a fascinating read, Pete. You also write in great detail about how autism can be dealt with the workplace. I think it's going to be of huge interest to many families impacted by autism in this country. And your book, Untypical, How the World Isn't Built for Autistic People and What We Should All Do About It, is published by Dark, and it's available now. Pete Warmby, thanks so much for chatting to me this morning. It's a great book.